Banker. Good morning, sir. You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Banker, representing the appellant, Plains Commerce Bank, in this appeal. At its core, what this case is about is whether the Long's discrimination claim was a federal claim or a tribal law claim. If it was a federal claim, that presents one kind of problem that I'd like to talk about today. And if it was a tribal law claim, that presents a different kind of problem that I'd also like to talk about.
What about, maybe it's not either, maybe it's just a big breach of contract action. We don't have to get into the nuances of state and tribal law.
Well, I do think that the question of whether the discrimination claim is federal or tribal is dispositive of this, and that there's not a way to preserve what happened before without answering that question.
Are the jury instructions a part of the record?
I believe that they are.
Very well. Go on, I'm sorry for interrupting you.
When we think about the jurisdictional question, I think we start with the general rule that tribal courts have no jurisdiction over non-members as a general principle. They're not courts of general jurisdiction. The sovereign powers of those tribal courts extend to the activities of the tribe with certain exceptions. And those exceptions are laid out by the U.S. Supreme Court decision in United States versus Montana. That case established a framework for analyzing these sorts of questions. And it established two exceptions to the general rule that tribal courts don't have jurisdiction over non-members. The first exception, the consensual relationship exception, and the second exception, what I would call the sovereign or the civil authority exception. I think we can dispense with the second Montana exception very quickly here. That was discussed in the briefs. I believe that the Tribal Court of Appeals and the Federal District Court in this case all recognize that there is no ability for a tribal court to entertain a federal law claim. And so that puts us back into talking about the first Montana exception, the consensual relationship exception. And here, what I think is important about the consensual relationship exception, again, we begin from the general principle that the tribal court doesn't have jurisdiction over non-members unless we fall within one of these exceptions. The way that the consensual relationship exception squares up here is we had a bank, Plains Commerce.
And of course, Kenneth was not in then, but his wife was, as I understand.
That's correct.
Didn't the bank have some benefit from the fact that they were dealing with a tribal entity because of the BIA loans and some of the other aspects of the case?
That is an aspect of the case that is part of the record. The bank was making loans to a South Dakota corporation. The South Dakota corporation was a closely held corporation, comprised of members of the tribe, and as part of doing business in that form, the transactions were eligible for Bureau of Indian Affairs partial loan guarantees. When we look at the consensual relationship exception under the Montana decision, it is a very limited and narrow exception to extending tribal court jurisdiction over non-members. And what the Supreme Court said in Montana about the first exception is that a tribe may regulate, through taxation, licensing, or other means, the activities of non-members who enter consensual relationships with the tribe or its members through commercial dealing, contracts, leases, or other arrangements. And when we parse the language of that exception and try to apply it to the facts in this case, we have a bank that isn't implicated by the tribe regulating through taxation or licensing, so we're into that other means language, which federal courts have interpreted as extending to the jurisdiction of Indian tribal courts to hear claims. But when we move further into the language of that exception, consensual relationships with the tribe, we don't have a consensual relationship with the tribe, so we need to move on, or its members. Well, the contractual relationship that was formed here was a contract between the bank and a South Dakota corporation. Now, to a certain extent, one could say that puts form over substance, but it's an important form.
Well, what about that South Dakota case? Was it called Bernier or Per? I don't remember, but that's a tax case.
Courier?
Yes.
I think that Courier is an anomaly. It did go into the analysis of looking at a closely held corporation that was comprised of members of a tribe, and in so doing, it established almost a racial identity for the corporation for the purposes of whether or not that entity was taxable. I think that that case flies in the face of other federal decisions that are explained in our brief that establish that there is no such thing as a corporate racial identity. The corporate form is important. Without the factual record to pierce the corporate veil, one wouldn't go any deeper into a relationship with a corporation and to look at who the individual members or stockholders of that corporation were. So it's a problem on its face to read the Poirier decision. There are things that you can take from the Poirier decision that appear to shed light on this question. I don't think it truly is applicable or that it can be something that you can square on all the facts or on the law in terms of what is the appropriate analysis under Montana 1 when you look at does a non-member of the tribe have a consensual relationship with the tribe or its members. I don't think Poirier sheds any light on that, but there is language there that is problematic and difficult to reconcile. So when we find ourselves in Montana 1, the first Montana exception, looking at the relationship between the bank and the South Dakota Corporation here, I think that's dispositive. I mean, if you begin from the principle under United States versus Montana that there is no general jurisdiction of tribal courts over non-members, and the consensual relationship here, the contract, was between the bank and the South Dakota Corporation, I don't think one can go any further than that. Now, the appellees have argued, well, you have to look further, you have to look at the fact that the members of the tribe were participants in that corporation, and that was important to getting the Bureau of Indian Affairs loan guarantees, but I don't think that that's part of the Montana 1 analysis. I don't think that takes us any closer to finding whether or not there's jurisdiction for the tribal court to adjudicate this claim. And so, you know, we start with the general idea that there ought not be jurisdiction under the first Montana exception at all.
But what about, did the bank concede that there was jurisdiction of the tribal court over the contract claim?
There is language to that extent in the Tribal Court of Appeals opinion where they attempted to define the scope of appeal. I don't know that the bank conceded that there was jurisdiction over the contract claim. They found themselves responding to a amended complaint in the tribal court, and in responding to it, challenged subject matter jurisdiction and also raised an alternative, a counterclaim, because to the extent that that court did have jurisdiction, they would need to litigate their claims in that form. And once the dispute is joined and the party has brought a claim, if it's the same relationship and transaction, then that was the bank's response. I don't think that the bank would.
To follow up on Judge Murphy, what was your client's response when they got served with the plaintiff's complaint? Did they move to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction?
They didn't move to dismiss, but they raised the jurisdictional defense in their answer and counterclaim.
And then Judge Gorman said, refers to paragraph 2 of one of the bank's pleadings. The court has jurisdiction over the Long family, and the court has jurisdiction over the subject matter of this action. Did your client make that statement in his pleading?
That statement is in a brief litigating summary judgment questions in the tribal district court, and it's directed more to the question of whether or not the tribal court can fully dispose of the claims before it on summary judgment. And There are inconsistent statements in the record made about jurisdiction that are difficult to reconcile, admittedly. I think what can be said is that subject matter jurisdiction either exists or it doesn't. It can't be created by consent. It can't be created by waiver. If the court didn't have jurisdiction, the court can't litigate those claims.
Accepting that as the correct statement of the law, it's still more than passing strange, isn't it? There was not a vigorous challenge to the district court, to the tribal court's jurisdiction.
Well,
strange or not, that we have the record is what the record is. So maybe there's no use speculating about why it wasn't pleaded or was pleaded.
I think there's no question that it was pleaded. The extent to which it was, that argument was raised, and then the litigation was conducted. I think at a certain point the proceedings took on a momentum of their own and it became a trial before a jury. But from the point of the first responsive pleading, the bank made clear that it didn't believe that this court had subject matter jurisdiction. And that is not something that was abandoned and never raised again. I mean, it was raised even in the jury instruction conference with the tribal district court.
Could the bank have gone into district court to try to get an injunction against staying this action or hold power? Enjoining it?
I don't think so. The intersection of law between tribal courts and federal courts and the ability of a non-tribal defendant to go in federal court before the tribal court has exhausted its proceedings is not completely clear. It seems that the better course of action from the teachings of the federal courts is that once you find yourself in that situation, you should let it go to completion and then you can come out and litigate the question of subject matter jurisdiction de novo in the federal courts.
Unless the law is so clear that there is no jurisdiction, hasn't the Supreme Court said, where it's so clear that there's no jurisdiction, then the injunction action would merely be a delaying action?
It's a question that needs to be asked anytime a non-tribal defendant finds themselves in tribal court. I think that the answer is indeterminate.
To what extent do you think Nevada versus Hicks and Strait leave open the question of tribal court jurisdiction here, or open it even further, put it that way?
I don't think that Hicks and Strait definitively answer the question, because the holdings of those decisions were narrowly tailored to the question that was before them. There is enough commentary through concurring opinions and dissenting opinions that I think one can read.
It's frustrating to us because, as Justice Scalia points out, we have never held that a tribal court had jurisdiction over a non-member defendant. And then we leave open the question of tribal court jurisdiction over non-member defendants in general. So I guess it's up to us. I mean, is it open to us to hold in this case that we think that there is tribal court jurisdiction?
I think this court would be the first court to do so in such a situation.
What about the Ninth Circuit case in the wrongful death action, the Smith case?
I think that the Smith case is distinguishable, and I think it stands alone as a court finding jurisdiction under a Montana 1 exception. I mean, what you had in the Smith case was what person who had originally been a defendant in tribal court.
Yeah, as they point out, it's a very complex procedural question, and the tribal court realigned the defendant as the plaintiff.
And I think that procedural complexity plays into the outcome of Smith and also the persuasive value of Smith.
I would have thought your answer to my question would have been Judge Gould's dissent is more powerful than the majority opinion in Smith, but
I think it is, but it isn't the holding of the court.
No, I know.
So we begin from the point of Montana 1 that under the consensual relationship exception there ought not be jurisdiction because there's not a consensual relationship with the tribe or its members. But I think then we move to a second layer of argument, which I think is more directly addressed by Nevada Hicks opinion, And that is, if this discrimination claim was a federal claim under 42 U.S.C. 2000D, that raises a real problem in that I don't believe that tribal courts have jurisdiction to litigate federal claims. And they're different from state courts, and that state courts have a right of removal, and that's a crucial part of the federal system.
Well, the court has made that quite clear, I think, but what about the Intertribal Court of Appeals ruling on that point? That they held it was not a 1983 action, basically it was a tribal court cause of action? Upon the tribal code?
The Tribal Court of Appeals said that it was a tribal common law discrimination claim.
But what is wrong with that analysis?
What's wrong with that analysis is that if you look at the record and you look at the way that this claim developed, it was clear to the tribal court judge, it was clear to the parties, I think, from looking at the record and the transcript, that this was a federal claim. And when it came up on appeal, recognizing that there's a problem with it being a federal claim, and taking the argument that the tribe asserted as amicus, that there's another way to salvage this result.
So the tribal court then, the appellate court then transmuted this into a tribal court civil rights action, as it were?
Essentially. And the problem with that is that idea has never been raised, it had never been discussed.
Well, that's why I asked if the jury instructions are part of the record here, and I assume that they are. I didn't see them quickly in the appendix, but they must be somewhere.
Weren't they pretty vague? The jury instructions, I mean, they didn't cite a particular law. They didn't cite the tribal code section or federal code.
They were vague in the sense that they didn't make explicit reference to much of anything in the actual jury instruction. What you can see from what is part of the record is a transcript of the conference with the court where the jury instructions were being considered. See what went into the thought process of how we arrive at the different instructions and how they should be framed. And so it's explicit in the pretrial jury instruction conference that everyone was working under the assumption that this was a federal claim. Now, up on appeal, it was converted into a tribal law, common law discrimination claim. The problem with that is that,
the other side says you weren't prejudiced. But I think you say that, well, if you had realized you were dealing with the tribal issue, then you would have, for example, called or deposed an elder, a tribal elder. Is that your showing of prejudice?
I think there's that aspect of prejudice that there needed to have been a record of what the law was, but even more important on the point of prejudice is if one is litigating in tribal court what one believes is an invalid federal law claim that will ultimately be reversed by the federal district court in a declaratory judgment action, one functions on one set of beliefs. If, on the other hand, you're litigating a tribal law, common law discrimination claim, you're in a different world. And not knowing the difference between, not knowing which world you're in is going to affect your evaluation of the claim and ability to conduct a settlement evaluation. If what the bank believed it was litigating and facing a federal discrimination claim which had no business being in tribal court. That had one effect on its settlement position. If, on the other hand, it had clearly known it was litigating a tribal common law discrimination claim, that would have the reverse effect on its thinking. So there is prejudice in not knowing what kind of claim you're facing. And there is unfair surprise in finding out for the first time on appeal that, in fact, what you were litigating was a tribal common law discrimination claim that had never been articulated or even defined. I mean, sitting here today, I don't think anyone could define what the elements of this tribal common law tort of discrimination are. There are serious problems with that from the due process standpoint. I see that my time has largely run out, so.
Well, I'm looking quickly at the discrimination counter. In the plaintiff's complaint, do they ever allege the equivalent of a 1983 action or a discrimination claim based upon racial elements of the bank's conduct?
There is no mention in the plaintiff's amended complaint of any federal statute whatsoever. So there is an allegation sort of a notice pleading of a discrimination claim of some kind, which...
I think the claim is that they sold the, bank sold the land less than what they would have gotten from somebody else or something. They sold $55 an acre less than the bank charged the longs. Is that discrimination? Is that the essence of their discrimination claim?
I think the essence of their discrimination claim is that they sold it to non-tribal members for a better rate than they were offering the longs.
And the intertribal appellate court, its opinion was struck by the claim, the statement in the bank's letter about Indian-owned entity and jurisdictional problems. Did they transmute that into the tribal? Do you think the Interappellate Tribal Court put too much emphasis on that part of the bank's letter?
I don't know that the Tribal Appellate Court focused that much on the actual facts of the underlying discrimination. I think it was more an attempt by that court to preserve what had been, you know, long-standing proceedings and a jury trial that had resulted in a jury verdict returned. And faced with that, I think the court wanted, in the interest of judicial economy, to do what it could to salvage that result if it was salvageable. In doing that, I think they did violence to the rights of the bank. I see that my time has expired, so.
Well, could I ask you another question? Our court frequently will affirm on another ground than the one that has been asserted. what do you say about that analogy as far as the tribe trying to save the verdict?
Well, the affirm on any ground, I mean, is a doctrine that appellate courts use to answer questions. It defines the scope of appeal. Although the Eighth Circuit has opinions that use the affirm on any ground language without any qualification, I think when you look closely at those opinions and the history of that doctrine, I think you'll find that the Eighth Circuit, even when they say affirm on any grounds without qualification, uses that mostly in a Rule 12 or 56 posture where it's a question of law. When you look to other circuits analyzing the same question, the 9th, the 10th, the 7th, they have made part of their analysis the explicit idea that in order for it to be able to affirm on any ground, it has to be something that was briefed and argued and litigated. When the tribal court took that doctrine and said affirm on any ground, I think it did so without an awareness of, you know, it took literally the idea that you can affirm on any basis that you want. And I don't think that's the right analysis. I think you can affirm on any basis that's part of the record that the parties have argued that is a legal question that doesn't require any factual development. I think in that posture, an appellate court can affirm on any ground supported by the record. But I think what the tribal appellate court did was read, both the tribal appellate court and the federal district court here, was read that affirm on any ground language too literally, without any of the protective qualifications that need to be part of that, which is that it is a legal question and it is something that the parties contemplated. If you could affirm on any grounds for a basis that a party never anticipated, that was not argued, it was not briefed, that just came out of left field, that really is not fair. I mean, it goes to the fundamental fairness of being able to know what claims are facing you and being able to respond to them appropriately. Thank you.
Very well. We'll hear from the appellees. Mr. Hurley, good morning. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you.
I don't want to waste your time, but I'm curious. You're a West River lawyer, so you understand ranching. This has nothing to do with the case, but the basis of the loss, get behind the podium, if you would, please, so that we can hear you. On the record. Where was this feed? Was it 8 miles away? The cattle feed that didn't get delivered to cause the cows to die?
It was about 20 miles from where the hay was put up and baled on the crop ground.
The cattle were
down in the Indian range unit on the trust land.
And the theory was that if he had gotten, what, a $70,000 loan, or was it $35,000, he could have hired stack movers to come in and move the hay.
Yes.
Well, that answers my question.
Thank you. May it please the court.
Counsel.
I'm Jim Burley from Rapid City, South Dakota, and I represent Ronnie and Lyle Long and the Long Family Land and Cattle Company. Ronnie and Lyle Long are American Indians. They live on the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribal Reservation. They've lived there all their lives. Ronnie's parents were Kenneth Long, his father, who was not a member, and Maxine, who was a member. They own land together, 2,300 acres on the reservation, and they raised their family there on a ranch or cattle ranchers. Lyle was raised on the reservation as well, and she and Ronnie were married, and they have raised their family there. Kenneth Long and now Ronnie Long have been 50 years there at cattle ranching on the reservation. The Longs and the bank did a lot of business together. Loans and promissory notes, so forth, since 1989. Ronnie's father, Kenneth, died in 1995, and something changed at the bank. The bankers came on the reservation out to the land and made a proposal. We want you to transfer this land to the bank. This is a proposal. Transfer the land to the bank. And we'll give you about $478,000 off your debt debt. And then we'll sell it back to you, sell the land back to you on a contract for deed. Bank financing, favorable terms, 20 years. Well, it sounded pretty good. A little while went by, and the letter came from the bank, and that was the one that was made mention earlier, is Trial Exhibit 4. And the bank said that we have a change of position. We talked to our lawyer, and we cannot sell it back to you on a contract because of possible jurisdictional problems. If the bank ever had to foreclose on this land, when it is contracted or leased to an Indian-owned entity on the reservation. So they talked and negotiated some more. The negotiations took place at the CRST tribal headquarters. They involved tribal officers working through the cash flows and taking inventories, helping the loans get this loan. It involved the Bureau of Indian Affairs, who guaranteed these loans on behalf of the United States. And what it boiled down to was that, well, the bank said we'll make you a 2-year lease. You pay us $44,000 a year for 2 years, and at the end of 2 years, you can buy your land back if you pay us $460,000-$470,000 in a lump sum. And Ronnie Long made it known to the bank that we haven't had any operating loan, operating money since Dad died in July. It's December. We very much need an operating loan. And they figured that out, and they had some help from the tribal officers, and it would be $70,000 for the year. And they needed money right away to move the hay that had been baled and put up on their land, move it down to the winter breaks, get a wooden draws for the cattle winter on the range unit on trust land. And that cost money to prepare the trucks and move some 400 tons of hay down there. That was part of the agreement. The bank said, we'll make you a $70,000 operating loan to get that done. And we'll also loan you $37,500 to buy 100 more calves so you can increase your income to help you buy your land back from the bank. In December 6th, those agreements were signed, a loan agreement and a lease with option to purchase. The days went by after December 6th. The bank never did make the $70,000 operating loan.
Did the bank make... I want to interject the words good faith. Did the bank make an attempt to get the BIA guarantee of that $70,000?
They wrote
And if
a letter.
So, what went wrong, other than the normal bureaucratic lapse of time?
The testimony was that prior to December 6th signing of the agreements, there was a meeting, and the tribal officers were there. They had helped running for credit cash flow. And that's Exhibit 8. And it shows that it worked with the cash flow. And the BIA approved it. Then there's a letter from the bank of December 12th, which was 6 days after the contract was signed, sent off to the BIA. And it had a different cash flow on it. It when you look at that case, well, it will not work. Everything is running in red ink. The BIA sees that in February, they write a letter back and they want a more complete application. There's no dispute that the bank never did reply to the BIA.
And so what caused the black ink to turn into red ink, as it were, on the cash flow?
I think, I don't know. There was testimony to that effect, but the $70,000 operating loan was changed to $85,000 because the loans needed more money. There was more spending to it, there was less income, and so as you drop down each month on the case flow, there were minuses across the board. So it didn't work.
Yeah, when did the loans find out about the the bank sale to other buyers?
Pardon?
When did the bank find out, when did the loans find out about the bank's sale to other buyers?
That was certainly not advertised. I think it was in March that the bank sold 320 acres to Mr. and Mrs. Pasica, who are non-members, at less money than they were requiring the loans. Then the bank went into tribal court in June and asked the tribal judge to serve a notice to quit on Ronnie and Lila Long and their children and give them off the land and on the Long company. And then didn't follow up on it any further except to have the Long serve, and never did get an order of eviction. And of course the Longs felt that the bank had breached their contract, and so they weren't going to move off their land, and they stayed put. And the bank never did get an order evicting them. However, in July, it was found out later, the bank actually sold some 1,905 acres to the Majeski family, and they're not members, they're large ranchers in the area. And here's the point of discrimination, is that the bank gave the Majeskis favorable, what one might call a sweetheart contract with either favorable interest rate, 7.75, 10 years to pay off, and the FSA payments and CRP payments were equal to the $23,000 a year payments on the contract. So the payments that we all make as taxpayers on this farm paid for the Majeskis to buy this farm. And had that favorable arrangement been made with the Longs, they could have bought their land back very easily, and there wouldn't have been this litigation. So they
even after, and this was after the loss of the cattle and the bad winter, or not?
Yes.
But you say even despite those catastrophic losses, they could have bought the land had they been given back, had they been given the same favorable terms.
Yes, for the reason that the FSA farm government payments and CRP payments paid the $24,000 a year, which is the contract payment necessary.
And the discrimination then at bottom had to be racial discrimination to make it a federal claim, as it were?
Well, it wasn't a federal claim.
Well, to make a claim of discrimination, tribal or federal.
Yes, on status base, on race base. The tribal law says that each person must be treated the same if they are in the same circumstances. And the bank brought this on themselves with this trial exhibit 4. They could have said that the Longs are turned down because of bad credit. No. They say that because you're an Indian-owned entity on the reservation.
So it's sort of like, what's the analogy in the mortgage loan and auto insurance? Redlining?
Yes.
No punning. Obviously, I'm not being flippant about it here, but that's the closest analogy I could think of. We're not making loans there.
What about the, are you going to get around to the jurisdiction dispute?
Pardon?
Are you going to get around to the jurisdiction dispute?
Yes. The jurisdiction dispute, as I understand it, involves the United States Supreme Court decision in Montana versus the United States. And as counsel for the bank was addressing, a two-pronged test. First of all, was there any consensual agreements, leases, contracts, arrangements between the bank and the loans? The answer is absolutely. Over the years, there have been many promissory notes, security agreements. The land was owned by Kenneth, a non-member, and his wife Maxine, a member, and the bank required mortgages on their land. Their house was on the reservation, owned by the two of them. Member owned by Maxine, and that had to be mortgaged to the bank to secure the loans. All the cattle that were always on the trust land, owned by the United States, as an allottee to members of the tribe and leased by Ronnie Long, they all bore the lien of the bank. Yes, there were many, many consensual relationships between the bank and the loans. And that matches or meets the first test. Now, the bank, you heard the bank counsel say, we think it's a rather ridiculous argument, that Long Family Land and Cattle Company cannot fit the first exception because, although they agree more than 51% ownership by American Indians, the corporation is a South Dakota corporation and cannot be a member of a tribe. While that is true, what is ridiculous about it is that the bank has benefited greatly from the Indian character of that corporation. If it's not owned by Indian people, you can't get very many fair guarantees. In this case, the bank, after the cattle died, collected approximately $400,000 from the Bureau of Indian Affairs on those guarantees. And so, yes, those guarantees are beneficial, and you can't get one of those unless you are an Indian person, or under the CFRs, it has to be incorporated. The Indian people who are members have to be actively managing the affairs of that corporation and actively working in it. And there has to be 51% ownership at all times, which there was here. And when Ronnie's mother, Maxine, died, she gave her shares to Ronnie. And of course, at all times, there was over 51% before that. And after Maxine died, there was a greater percent. So those BIA guarantees were helpful, and they do recognize the Indian character of the corporation. And as the judge was asking earlier, bank counsel, yes, the Poirier case is very important. The South Dakota Supreme Court studied this very opinion. And in that case, the court came to the conclusion that under federal law, of course, there's an Indianness or Indian character in terms of the tax exemptions, in terms of, in our case, the BIA guarantees. And that is a fact of life, and it's a very important fact in this case. Therefore, we believe it's clear that jurisdiction in the tribal court does exist under the first exemption or prong or test of Montana versus Sea West. The second test is also very, very important, and Attorney Tom Van Norman may speak to that as well, as he represents the CRST. But the second,
I see you're cutting into Mr. Van Norman's time.
Oh.
Let's see, I think you agreed to take 10 minutes, and he was going to take 10 minutes.
Okay.
How much time
That's
is
correct.
Left for?
7 minutes.
Oh, I see, I'm sorry. I shouldn't tell you how to spend your time.
And if I may, I'll just
7 minutes of Mr. Van Norman's time.
I'll just finish that thought that the second exemption provides jurisdiction in the tribal court where the behavior of the bank, the conduct of the bank, threatens the economic welfare of the tribe. And we would submit that that's exactly what happened here. Thank you. I'll defer the rest of the time to Attorney Van Norman.
Very well. Mr. Van Norman, good morning. You may proceed.
Morning, Your Honors. Tom Van Norman, tribal attorney for the Cheyenne Versailles Tribe, of which I'm a member. Oyate Wachina, if I may have a bit to do with that. I wanted to, in my Lakota language, say my Indian name, as people depend on him. and it's a good day, and I'm glad to be here for this court, and thank you for accepting oral argument. Because nothing is more central to our people than fairness, we continue to strive for fairness. This case is not about anything technical, it's simply about fairness. The tribe, as worse as it is, being in the counties that are 7th and 29th poorest in all of America, as poor as Pine Ridge. This is how it is in South Dakota for us, and this is how we live. Barely getting by, and we barely get enough to fund our courts, but we do maintain an excellent system. And it's a fair system, with qualified people who look at this case carefully. And it is indeed an ironic thing for the bank, when you look at the pleadings, when you look at the facts, to continue to mischaracterize things from the record. And I would submit from the law, if you look to, for example, the, I guess it's a Graylight versus Cook case out of the Western Central Division of Missouri, that goes to the issue of can the court affirm on any basis? And the question that was posed back by the bank in its brief was kind of discounting that case and the authority for the court, for any court, to uphold the lower court's ruling. And we did pick up out of the archives of some effort the actual pleadings. I'm not sure if it's appropriate, but I would advise the court that there's an issue there, and we believe the court has full authority. That matter, in that case, was not pled before. They were completely raised in footnote 9 of the case, completely raised a new theory on appeal that was not discussed below or not pled below. And I think that's significant as we go piece by piece. Now again, ironically, out of fairness, what happened, I came in as the tribe's lawyer on the appellate level when the jurisdiction of the tribe was challenged. Rather than pay the judgment, the bank, as it has a right to do, chose to challenge jurisdiction. Now ironically, the bank during oral argument and the Court of Appeals admitted that they came here to make money. And they said that's not the issue. In fact, in our, I want to just quote from that proceeding briefly. The bank admits that they were dealing with tribal members to make money. It wasn't just to help tribal members. The bank was dealing with the intent of making money. That's what any business does. And how much money they made from tribal members is really nothing for us to even worry about. And then they went on to say, that's why I'm concerned, not just with the bank. The bank has got the money to pay the judgment, Your Honors. What I'm concerned with is that this bank is not acting on its own. There are a number of banks around that are looking at this case, not just this tribe. There are a number of banks around. Let me tell you, if they want to discriminate against tribal members, they can do it and get by with it. They can. They don't have to make everybody loans. They can find a reason for rejecting the loans. That was significant to the Court of Appeals, and they took it, like I did, as a threat, not just to the tribal members, but to the tribe itself and to all tribes and all the units in the state of South Dakota, saying, watch this case. If you don't come out our way, we're not going to loan anybody. What we didn't do in this case, well, actually, on the facts of this case, as the court was inquiring, the Majestys, who were next door, who were non-Indian neighbors, who were the local, they have a lot of land up there, let's put it that way, on a reservation, which is legal. But what happened here was sort of a strange thing that they got a freebie when it came up. They got the CRP payment and FSA payment. So they're going to have to go out of pocket, is my understanding, and look to the record. But that's what Mr. Hurley was articulating to the court. The bottom line is they picked up this portion of land, over half of the land that the Longs had in their family for generations. When their non-Indian dad died, suddenly everything changed. The redlining in South Dakota is noted in a federal district court case by Judge Schreier in the case of Bonechurch versus Nelson. That discrimination is past and ongoing in a variety of things. And so it's a grave concern for the tribe that its members in the tribe be threatened with financing. And especially now, we had, in this case, you had the worst record, winter. 96 to 97, when they lost almost all their stock due to freezing death. If they had that operation alone, they would have saved them and kept buying it. But something went wrong. the bank, and they stopped. They did not fulfill, as the record speaks, and they breached. This is a case, as the court indicated, about a breach. There are no economic or punitive damages going to the tort, the discrimination claim, saying that there was something wrong here from discrimination. And the bank won a bunch of its claims in court, won some remedies on post-judgment relief, got a special judgment trial appointed for 2 days, had all kinds of opportunities to submit motions, and continued to avail itself of the tribe's jurisdiction. They came in and made lots of money. In fact, they collected upwards of about $800,000 from the loans of this business transaction. But when something went wrong and they had to pay, they didn't want to. And they still don't want to, even though the court came out fairly.
Well, what about the bank's assertion that, you know, it's fundamentally unfair to be thinking that you're dealing with a federal claim at the trial level and then to have the Court of Appeals say it wasn't a federal claim, but it was based on tribal law?
Well, I think when you go back to the complaint and go back to the pleadings, look at the record quickly, you'll see that the bank's claims are not supported. It wasn't a federal claim at all. There's some reference when I look to what statutes could we borrow to make up a rule, and it was not a federal claim. They're trying to make it look that way, I guess, to challenge jurisdiction and then try and defeat the judgment and the subsequent appeal and award.
Judge Womack, can I ask another question?
Of course.
This isn't really about this case, but is your tribal court, does it develop written case law?
Yes, it does. And our Court of Appeals is reported in the Indian Law Reporter. And frequently, Justice Parmesan, the University of South Dakota Law, is on there, and Justice Clinton, who was transferred from the University of Iowa down south. They are two Indian law experts on our panel. And the third is a tribal member familiar with tribal culture.
Now, the tribal court of appeals decision in this case reported in the Reporter?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And there's a transcript of this proceeding which is in place, which is a lengthy argument.
Are there reported cases dealing with tribal discrimination case based on tribal law, either the code or the common law?
In the code, the tribes on our code speaks generally to the types of things that submit people to jurisdiction, talking about property, land, and kinds of claims that tribal members and others can go to court with. And the tribe revised its constitution in 92 so that all civil matters could be submitted to the tribe and the courts would be open for everybody. These decisions, there are several decisions cited in the record below. The tribe's brief on amicus talking about these Lakota notions of fairness and fair dealing. And to me, Your Honor, that speaks of protecting people from unfairness, and that includes discrimination.
But in terms of fairness, let's speak of fairness in the legal sense of being advised of what law applies to you as a bank, let's say, and what you'll have to defend against. I was struck by some of Justice Souter's comments in his concurrence in the Hicks case about tribal courts differing often from other American courts and often from one another, and the resulting law applicable in tribal courts is a complex, and he quotes here, mix of tribal codes and federal, state, and traditional law. He cites from the National American Indian Court Judges Association. Courts, which would be unusually difficult for an outsider to sort out. Is there any sense of unfairness to this bank or any outside entity in being able to find out what law? Put it this way. I was thinking about this case. Suppose I were still practicing law in Aberdeen, South Dakota. We represented the bank there. They had come to me, and they would have asked me, would there be any problem in foreclosing on this? And I would have said, well, there might be. Would I be, in effect, fomenting racial discrimination by saying that there's a jurisdictional problem? I mean, cannot one speak in terms of jurisdictional problems without being considered a racist or discrimination?
Certainly, Your Honor, but on the facts of the case, it's up to the court to decide. In this case...
And if my bank client had said, well, what's the law in the Cheyenne River Tribe? Do they have... Well, most bankers wouldn't ask this question. Do they have the equivalent of 1983? What would any lawyer be able to say? In other words, you have to advise your clients in the private sector. What could a lawyer advise a bank regarding the law of the Cheyenne River Tribe? When it came, in terms of commercial relationships, the power to foreclose, the power to evict, and all that sort of thing.
No, well, one could advise to look up the South Dakota Supreme Court website and look at the tribal codes and look at the court rules that are published.
So the law is available.
Laws are available.
Probably much more now than they were in 1964.
Certainly. Also, one can check the Secretary of State website in South Dakota and look and see the Uniform Commercial Code Agreement between the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe and the State of South Dakota under Joint Powers Agreement for the last 7 years, approximately, where people can go and file and secure their investment using the UCC process for secure articles of Article 9. And like any place else, you do need to go and research the jurisdiction and find out. And also, when you're doing your case, you need to move to dismiss, you need to move to strike, and you need to do some discovery if you have a question when you're in litigation. In this case, that wasn't done, and here we are in the bank saying unfairness. And it's ironic, again, to claim that all the way at the end of appeal, during the Tribal Court of Appeals, when they had the full jury trial, could have got non-Indians to serve the jury, and didn't use any of those processes. They're in the 78 Law and Order Code, which has been up at the State Supreme Court Library since. There's a lot of dust on that copy, but it's been well published. Those are available from the Tribal Secretary's office. And laws are much more available. We have all kinds of tribal codes. There are 70 number codes. It's not that the law's in a vacuum. It's that in this particular case, on a particular facts, the jury and the trial court looked at this for 2 days, and there were post-trial motions for relief. And it was not an unfairness in how it was decided. The bank won a lot of those claims when we look back to the record. And our appeal had that opportunity. And here we are today, Your Honor.
Even beyond fairness, even beyond, I mean, if we were to uphold jurisdiction in this case, would you agree that it would be a case of first impression involving commercial transactions between a bank and a member of a tribe nationwide?
I'm not certain, Your Honor, because I'm aware of other states that are trying to work out commercial agreements.
But in terms of litigation, court is, well, put it this way. I would think, however we rule in this case may very well go to the Supreme Court. Because the fact that, as I pointed out in my earlier remarks, Justice Scalia noted that the court has never squarely ruled on this point. Well, I don't want to extend the time further. Do we have any questions? Yes.
If I may, I would interject and say, Bootsy Williams, you lead in that the tribes reason now, because there's examples of regulating that conduct for contract.
And I suppose the answer to that is that involved a commercial establishment on the reservation or something. But anyway, no, I'll grant you that may be your closest
and case. If I may answer, the Ninth Circuit has withdrawn its opinion.
In Smith?
In the Ford Motor Company.
Oh, the Ford,
case. And I just saw that come out. I printed it out last night, that's February 7th. They withdrew that opinion and remanded for exhaustion of tribal remedies. But that's a mark showing that the district court was right here in looking at these particular facts. And also in a similar case, it's the same judge who looked at the Procreate Children's Fund case and on different facts came out the other way. Involving corporations. But as far as the tort, we're looking at an area like the Ninth Circuit did with the college. In that kind of scenario, it depends on what happens in the case and litigation. And the tribe should have an ability to protect its members from wrong. And that's the bottom line, I believe, Your Honor.
And you might want to, when you get back to your chambers or office, to send us a 28-J letter on the withdrawal of the Ford case. We can find it through Westlaw, but if you want it in part of a record, why don't you send us a 28-J letter with a copy to counsel?
I will, Your Honor.
Thank you. Well, we've extended time for all in this case. We'll give you a couple of minutes, Mr. I believe he used all of his time.
Yes, Your Honor.
Or we did. You may have 3 minutes, Mr. Banker.
Just a couple of points I'd like to make. I want to be clear that, and not leave this court with the impression that the bank is in the business of discriminating. And that was the flavor of the commentary and the quote. There is a problem, and I think that's what led to the comment at the Court of Appeals. There's a problem with tribal law jurisdiction.
Mr. Gronwald probably could have used more circumspect language. I can understand the argument you're making. The banks are faced with a problem. And if we are not sure how to advise our clients, or if the banks don't know what their rights are, then maybe they won't be able to make those loans and the tribal members will suffer. I guess that was the essence. As you see it, that was the essence of his argument?
That is the essence of the argument. You asked a question earlier about what could someone do today looking at, you know, what is the nature of discrimination law in the tribe. And I think the answer to that question can be found in the Tribal Court of Appeals' opinion. The Tribal Court of Appeals cites two provisions of its tribal code, both dealing with personal jurisdiction over tort claims. And then to build on that, saying, well, once we've established jurisdiction over tort claims, we look to these two opinions to develop the idea that there is a common law right of discrimination. You can access those opinions, you can read those opinions. They have nothing to do with discrimination. They are tort claims. I have not been able to find anything that would shed any light on what the nature of tribal law, the tribal common law tort of discrimination is. It struck me that the Tribal Court of Appeals' opinion in this case recognized for the first time this idea of tribal law, tribal court discrimination, common law discrimination. And, I mean, at a minimum, if that was the way that the Tribal Court of Appeals was going to go and announce for the first time that there was this common law of tribal discrimination, it seems that the more appropriate course in achieving fairness would have been to send it back. Because if you look at what the trial court said in its post-trial opinion...
Send it back for what?
Send it back for further proceedings to clarify the nature of the claim being presented to the jury. If you look at what the tribal district court said in its post-trial opinion, it was clear in that judge's mind that he had submitted a federal claim to the jury.
And I don't want to take your time, but that is a troublesome point. I mean, I find it a troublesome thing, but maybe the interpellate tribal court adequately dealt with it.
The tribal district court thought it had submitted a federal claim and found out after reading the Tribal Court of Appeals' opinion that it hadn't. At a minimum, what that calls for is to send it back so the tribal district court judge can have it right in submitting.
But to what extent can we put the discrimination claim aside, as it were, and still uphold the verdict on the ground of the breach of contract? They agreed to make the $70,000 loan. They didn't follow through adequately. As a result, the cattle were lost. Now, as a farm boy from South Dakota, I might wonder about the but-for relationship, but the jury took care of that. We're not here to talk about the merits of the jury's decision.
I mean, there's a lot of facts, and there are facts in dispute about how this relationship played out. But the question is not whether there's a claim to be litigated, a dispute between the parties. The question is whether that dispute was properly litigated in the tribal courts. And I think the answer to that question is that it was not. What the bank would ask is that this court reverse the federal district court's grant of summary judgment for the Longs and grant summary judgment for it, giving it the relief that there was no jurisdiction in the tribal court and that there was no due process.
And where does that leave the Longs with their claim?
Where that leaves the Longs with their claim is holding a claim that cannot be recognized in state or federal court under the principles of comedy.
So they're left without a remedy?
Well, they're left with a remedy to the extent that they have a judgment in tribal court that can be used in state or federal court for execution proceedings.
Would they be stopped from bringing a federal action on a breach action? Or would that tribal court thing be raised judicata?
I haven't considered or studied that question, but I would have my gut instinct.
Well, how could it be raised judicata if it didn't have jurisdiction?
Pardon me?
How could it be raised judicata if it didn't have jurisdiction, which is your argument?
I'm not sure what the right answer to that question is.
I guess we have enough problems without dealing with that. Do we have further questions? Again, we tried to give extra time to all because it is an important case, and I doubt very much that it will be stopping in our court. But no matter how, the case is submitted, we will take it under consideration.